welcome dear listeners to this week's episode of Afternoon Satsang. As always, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with me is Brother Arvind. And we are coming to you live from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam. We are continuing the discussion that we started last week. This is the fortnight we dwell into the book Conversations with Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba by Swami's devotee, Dr. John Hislop from the United States. We've started going through these discourses. I think, if I'm not wrong, this is the 12th episode in this series. And these are conversations that Swami had with him, maybe in the interview room where others were present, or on occasions when we were talking to one of the devotees, Mrs. Ratanlal. She had also said that some of the sessions were held in her house. So in some informal settings like that, sometimes in the interview room. So he is recorded, transcribed, and presented in the form of book, these conversations. And some of them are very, very profound. Very deep questions are being asked to Swami, and Swami is answering them very specifically, sometimes for the questioner, but sometimes in a manner that we all can draw a lot of inspiration from. And that's the joy that we are getting now, going through some of these conversations. Last time around, when we were going through these conversations, there was a discussion on peace, where one of the visitors, along with present in the group, asked Swami this question: how do we get peace? And Swami established the importance of desires in the whole equation, how you have to curb your desires in order to get peace. And one of the best ways of doing that is to increase one's love for God. And we had spoken of how all of that is connected. And Swami also spoke of the importance of confidence, and the kind of company that you keep of all of that plays an important part. But today we'll be continuing with that conversation. We are going to talk about another important topic. Before that, let's invite Arvind to join all of us. Sairam, Arvind.
Sairam, Prem, and Sairam to all our dear listeners. Last week where we stopped was when Hislop asks Swami that when is it our intellectual understanding turns into reality? Because all these things we are able to appreciate and understand in our mind, but we don't seem to be experiencing it. And Swami says that it will become a reality only when you practice it intensely. And Swami goes on to specify further that when you wish to practice, it is not as if you have to practice everything that you have heard or read. In fact, Swami advises him to read less and practice something regularly and intensely more. Swami says that when you go to a hospital, you will find medicines for all kinds of diseases. You need not take all the medicines. You need to only take that medicine which is relevant to you. And that's enough, you are cured and you become healthy. So also for our spiritual health, it is not as if we need to take in every kind of spiritual medicine. Rather than that, we should take one or two that we need and practice it. Take it with a regular dosage. And so therefore, Hislop asks the question, what does the supreme spiritual doctor say is the correct medicine for me? So now that Swami has said that you take only what you need, he's asking Swami, what is it that I need? And Swami says, meditation. For in meditation, you first get sense control. And yoga will help you with the body. And when the mind is steady, concentration will come automatically. When you get such concentration, then you will get peace of mind. So you see, Swami is actually tying up two questions together. The previous question was about getting peace, and here Hislop is asking further to that question as to what is the medicine for me. And Swami says meditation is good for you because meditation helps you to get sense control. Along with meditation, practice a little yoga, which will help you to get body control. When the body is steady and the senses are controlled, then concentration will come automatically. And concentration, of course, is the first step towards meditation, because Swami says it's concentration which goes to contemplation and then to meditation. So meditation is what Swami prescribes for Hislop. You know, it feels like Swami is taking such a stepwise approach, because when we say meditation, finally it is the process in which we void our mind of all thoughts. The mind ceases to exist, because Swami says that a mind is a cloth that is made up of so many threads, and each of those threads is a line of thought. So once the thoughts are gone, there is no cloth at all. So meditation is a process in which we obliterate the mind completely. And therefore there is peace. There is complete peace, there is complete fulfillment, complete joy. But as we stated, the first step in meditation is concentration. And concentration possibly helps us to concentrate. You know, concentrate meaning in chemistry we had this process of concentration, where in order to increase the chances of success of a reaction, we will make a concentrate of the reactants. Concentrate meaning the percentage of that reactant in that solution will be increased, meaning all the other things will be removed. So in that sense, to concentrate meaning possibly before reaching a state of no thoughts, you start reaching a state of one thought. Or possibly before reaching a state of one thought, you reach a state wherein it's just a few thoughts. You have reduced all the other thoughts. And that is why the first stage is concentration, where you concentrate on one object, one name, one subject, something, so that you don't think of anything else. Of course, when we begin meditation, there is a chance that though I'm trying to focus on one thing, other thoughts keep coming in. But by the very act of putting in effort to focus on one thing, there is definitely a reduction in the number of other thoughts. So this is the process of concentration.
And Swami gives beautiful analogies to explain this, you know, the process of concentration. I think in one of the discourses, Swami says that when the mother wants to feed the kid, and the kid will be running all over the place, the first thing the mother has to do is catch the kid and make it sit in one place. Right? And then the next step of making the child eat the food.
Correct.
So if the child does not sit in one place, the mother is not going to be able to feed. So Swami would say that step of making the child sit down in one place is concentration, where you make it sit in one place, and Swami would call that from going from multi-pointedness to one-pointedness. And, Swami had, I think, very beautifully described in a discourse that the most useless state is no-pointedness, that, you know, you're just whiling away time, basically. You're not doing anything of importance. And the next is multi-pointedness. We think of that as a very productive state because we think that we are, you know, multitasking, but actually it is not so. But it's just that you're distracted. You know, when you're doing something, you're thinking of something else. There's a possibility of you not doing anything properly. But then Swami says from that multi-pointedness, you come to this one-pointedness, the ability to concentrate on that one thing that you're doing. Swami says that's the point where concentration comes. And many times Swami would say that people mistake this concentration to be meditation. And they think that, you know, if they're able to sit down and do meditation for, in that sense, sit and contemplate on one thing for 10 minutes, they are meditating. Swami says that is not meditation. In fact, when we were talking to one of the old students, he was saying that he was probably in his senior year when Swami called for an interview of the Bhajan Boys. And in that group, there were also some freshers. So in the course of the interview, Swami suddenly asked them, so any of you do meditation here? So he was saying the seniors knew Swami's stand on meditation and what it is. So nobody dared to even open their mouth. One of these freshers put up their hand. He said, Swami, I do. And Swami was like, oh, very nice, you do meditation. So what time do you do meditation? She said, Swami, I do it 5 in the morning. Oh, Brahma Murtam, very nice. And Swami very innocently asked him, so how long do you do meditation? He said, Swami, I do for 20 minutes. Swami asked him, 20 minutes you do meditation? He said, yes, Swami, 20 minutes I sit and do meditation. And then Swami, you know, in his characteristic way, he told, if you really meditate, you will not know it's 20 minutes. Because he said meditation is a state where you lose track of time and you lose track of where you are.
You go beyond time, I guess.
Right? You go beyond time. So that has always been Swami's stance on what meditation is. But he says that concentration also has its benefits. Even that sitting down and trying to meditate in the form of concentration also has its benefits, because you will see that that productivity increases in whatever else that you do, because your ability to concentrate increases basically.
Absolutely. In fact, when we see the hostel schedule, Swami has kept only about 1.5 hours in the late evening for studies. I mean, they are called study hours. And Swami would say that is enough, because if you focus and study during that time, it is enough to get all your grades and all your marks, all your success. And we have gone through that system and seen how true that is. So this concentration is not something that we need only for spiritual growth. It is something that we need in our day-to-day activities. Now, you brought up the term multitasking. There was a time when it was considered that a person who can multitask is better at doing a work. Interestingly, I came across some research and I was reading it up where they say that this concept of multitasking is a myth. Because what it was assumed to be previously was that your mind is able to dedicate some part of its resources to one work, some more part of its resources to another work. In this manner, the mind is able to allocate resources to multiple tasks at the same time. And therefore, a person who can multitask can utilize his brain or mind, whatever, better and achieve more in the lesser time. But recent research revealed that the mind does only one thing at a time. And therefore, when you are multitasking, basically what you are doing is switching it across different tasks, off, on, off, on, off, on, off, on. So for 5 seconds you do one task, then you switch off the mind from that, switch it on to the other, then you switch it off from that and switch it on to the other. This keeps happening, and when you think you are multitasking, actually you are switching off and switching on rapidly multiple times, which is more energy consuming, which is more distracting. In fact, if you are able to multitask, it's a feat in itself, not because you are a multitasker, but because you are somehow able to still keep the connection between the tasks. Otherwise, it is very, very difficult. Instead, what that research recommends is that you sit and complete the tasks one at a time. You will end up doing those tasks in a much better fashion, much better manner. So doing one at a time is always advantageous. If you have to sweep the house, wash the dishes, do some typing of an article, something like that, it is better that you do them one at a time rather than do little of this, little of that, little of this. Take it like if in an examination you're sitting and you have to answer 10 questions, each for say 5 marks. So you have to write about 200 words for each answer. How would it be if you write 10 words for each answer and, you know, go like that, question 1, 2, 3, 10 words each, then go from question, you know, because if you do that way, it is more difficult than actually answering each question on its own. We have seen children, you know, when they're learning numbers, when they have learnt it in the wrong manner, the way they write numbers, they reach 20, and then instead of writing 21 to 30, they fill the left-hand column, left-hand square with 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, and then they write 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 0. Then 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, then again 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. It may seem, but it's getting it all wrong, and you have not understood it also well. Therefore, in the same way, this multitasking is a myth which we need to give up. And we need to realize that concentration is not just the first step of meditation. Concentration is a requisite for success in our day-to-day life in whatever we do. Not just in terms of our career or our academics. In terms of our day-to-day activities at home. Even whether I'm watching TV, a television program, or playing a video game. Even things like that. You know, there are some people whom I have seen who in 3 hours finish watching 3 movies. They sift across channels. So, since it's for entertainment, it's alright. But if you were to tell them that, tell me what is the story in each of the 3 movies, there will be so many things they have missed out. Because the mind cannot multitask. It just cannot do it. It has to switch off from one story and switch on to another story. If we remember this, we will realize the importance of this concentration in meditation. Because it helps if you are able to focus on only one thing at a time. Forget one thing at a time. At least if we can come to focus on 2-3 things at a time, it's much better. Because our mind, as you said, is like a child running all around. Keeps running about and hundreds of things keep coming. And therefore, though concentration is not meditation, it's one of the primary steps to meditation. And it's very, very important for day-to-day life.
And what Swami is saying here specifically, you know, is very, very important. Because it's precisely what Patanjali Yoga Sutra is all about. When he's saying that you do meditation first to get sense control and then do yoga for the body. And when the mind is steady, concentration will come automatically and then you'll have peace of mind. It's precisely what you talk of, yama, niyama, pratyahara, asana, pranayama, and dharana, dhyana and samadhi, where Swami is saying that all of that happens. The whole idea of, you know, now we have the idea of yogasana and pranayama only for the body. The idea behind yoga in the initial years was that the worry of the body can be taken care of by these asanas. You know, you don't have to worry about that, so that the mind can be allowed to concentrate and meditate. But we have separated that completely, and we think that yogasana is for people who want to be fit and dhyana is for people who want to be spiritual. It's actually for the whole idea is the spiritual journey.
It's a comprehensive
journey,
package.
It's a comprehensive thing, and you cannot, removing one from the other actually makes both meaningless. So Swami is saying that you practice yoga also because that will give you health in the body. And you do meditation of the mind. Swami is very clearly saying that it will lead to sense control and it will eventually lead to concentration. And Swami would say this especially when talking to students. You know, it's understandable, you know, when you come and join Swami's college. I know a lot of my classmates who had that misconception that here is Swami's college. So here the first subject is meditation and then you have chemistry, physics and whatever else. So all that is spiritual needs to be given preference. But once you come to the hostel, you'll realize that, you know, the only thing which differentiates everything is Swami becomes the center of all activities. But otherwise there is nothing like you specifically go and do some meditation or you're made to do some vigorous sadhana and thing like that. Otherwise it's just the regular prayers and things go on like that. The reason is when you go into a college like this, you think that this is a spiritual place, so I should do something more spiritual. And some of the students who were in the 80s, they would say that it was almost like an epidemic, where a lot of these students would take on, Kundalini yoga and all kinds of meditations, because they thought that that's what they had to do, being in a spiritual place. And Swami would come and advise against it. Swami would tell them that, see, you're doing it all wrong. You never start with these practices. Swami says it starts with yama and niyama. It starts with discipline, personal and social discipline. That keeping yourself clean, speaking the truth, being, you know, punctual to your duty and your honesty and all of that. And of course, the way you treat others, the way you put up with others, all of that comes in. And eventually, you get the last three, Swami says, is, you know, dhyana, dharana and samadhi. But what do? The day you come to the hostel, you sit down, close your eyes with a half smile on your face, you think you're already in samadhi. It's not like that, and that's precisely what Swami is telling you, that you have to do all of this, each one has its place, and then eventually you'll get peace of mind. You cannot go and order straight for peace of mind and have it delivered onto your table.
Then actually, you know, there is so much that Swami has spoken about meditation and how to do it, the practical aspect, tips and different things. In fact, dear listeners, when we went through, we found it so comprehensive and so detailed. We felt that it would be better that sometime in the future we do a separate satsang on meditation itself. So we will not go into that now. We will continue with what the conversation goes on. Hislop then tells to Swami, when after Swami says that when you get such concentration, then you'll get peace of mind. Hislop says, Swami says that all is done by the Lord and not by you. But the world over, there is the concept that man is responsible for his own actions. Swami replies, you are God. As long as you are being human, there may be such thoughts. So, just going ahead, Hislop then says, as long as you are being human, does that imply that the human state is an act of one's will? And Swami says, no, not an act of will, just a matter of being confused. It is delusion. So, over here now, Hislop asks Swami if everything is done by God. This is another question that a lot of us get in the mind. You know, there is that famous quote that says, not even a blade of grass moves without his will. So we say that not even a blade of grass moves without his will, then all the evil in the world is because of God, right? We say it like that. It's like picking up two theories which are right and putting them together without the context to come up with something very bizarre. It's almost like that, and that is what Hislop is saying. Swami, you are saying that everything is done by God, but world over people say that man is responsible. So what it is? And Swami's answer is very simple. He says it's a matter of perspective. You are essentially divine. If you are looking, viewing from the divine perspective, then yeah, whether you say you're doing it or God is doing it, it's the same because you are God. But if you feel that there is God and you're human, then yes, the perspective becomes different. So, you know, this is so easily appreciable when we think of science and motion, you know. We say in science that the earth revolves around the sun. But then, that is with respect to observation from the sun. Because the sun itself is moving. The solar system itself is moving. You know, when you say a car is moving on the land, it is because we are assuming the land to be stationary and relative to the land, the car is moving. But then, the earth itself is revolving. And the solar system itself is moving. The galaxy itself is moving. So, it is only relatively we can say something. So, in a similar manner, perspective is everything over here. So, Swami is saying that when you are being human, yes, it holds good that man is responsible for his actions. But you are essentially divine. From that perspective, it is God who is doing everything.
So, of course, it's a very complex topic. The reason why I think many of us don't understand this is because, you know, in the world, we always talk in binaries, you know, in the wakeful state.
Hmm.
Either I'm here or I'm at home. You know, I cannot be in both places. Either I'm doing this or I'm not doing this. We always think of truth as being, you know, wholesome. It's
digital.
Digital. It cannot be this and that. But here what Swami is saying is, yeah, actually you're divine, but because you think that you're human, it's like that. So it's like saying that, you know, but then we always ask this question, but Swami, what is the truth? Because if everything is God's will, then there is no individual will. Or if there is individual will, then there is individual will which can
change
God's will. So you cannot have both. But that is why, you know, what Swami goes on to tell after this is actually very important. Maybe we'll come back into that question again, where Swami says that, you know, not an act of will, just a matter of being confused. It is a delusion. You come here with doubts. Swami knows that, so he gives you a chance to ask. If a jnani comes, a man with direct experience of the divine, Swami does not ask him what his doubts are. The fact that you have questions is evidence that you are on the worldly level. Baba's teachings will vary according to the level of the person. If you look at it, you know, Swami talks of delusion. And when you talk of delusion, it's a completely different thing. One of the most classic examples which Advaita always gives is that of, you know, the rope being mistaken to be the snake.
Mm.
Right? Technically speaking, it's either a rope or a snake. But the fact that you think it's a snake sets off a lot of thoughts in your mind.
Mm.
It cannot deny the fact that I'm getting scared now. It cannot deny the fact that I'm thinking of my investments or what will happen to my children or what will I get back from this place or will I have to go to a hospital after this.
That is as real as...
Right, those thoughts are real because though their thoughts are based on delusion, the thoughts are real.
Mm.
The fear is real. It's causing real chemical changes in my body. The adrenaline is rushing. The reaction is real, but it's based on a delusion. And that's what Swami is saying, that it is based on a delusion that you're human. That's why you think that you're responsible. Actually, no one is, you are not, everything is divine. But as long as the delusion is there, same thing that, you know, the moment you see that, I think there was a previous question also which Swami spoke about this, where Swami was talking about experience, where he was saying that when there is half knowledge, there's always doubt. And that half knowledge is like twilight, Swami was saying.
Mm.
So similarly, it's in twilight that you see this rope as a snake. And when in twilight you see it, you're not sure. You ask the question, is it a snake or a rope? That is a sign that you are in twilight.
Mm.
And similarly, Swami is saying the very fact that you are coming and asking questions means that your knowledge is not complete. Because if the knowledge is complete, it's like bright sunlight and you don't need to ask anybody. You see a rope as a rope, you see a snake as a snake.
You know, whenever this matter of delusion comes up, somehow an example that I always relate to because intellectually it clarifies things for me is all the world's a stage and everybody is an actor. Now we have a stage with everybody as actors on it. Every actor has a dual personality, if I may say so. One as an actor, the other as the role that he or she is playing. So, like you said, it's not that either I'm an actor or I'm the role. I'm both. Both exists. Both exist. It's not that if this exists, that cannot exist. I am an actor and I am acting this role. So in the role I might be a beggar, but because I'm stricken with poverty there, I actually don't feel sorrow within. But at the same time, it doesn't mean that, you know, when I'm in the drama, suppose my wife comes and says, oh God, today also we didn't get enough money, we don't have food, what do we do? I will also sit and say, oh yes, something we have to do. If this can't go on for long, if this goes on for long, our children are starving. The reality, my children are not starving. They're not my children also. They're nothing. Means they're all actors. I know that. But still, I do my role to perfection. Because that is what I also feel is the perspective that I'm seeing from. If I am looking at the role, then yes, the rules of the world, karma, all that holds good. My effort determines my fate. If I don't put effort, if I don't go out and beg tomorrow, I will not get my food for tomorrow. All that holds good. But actually, I need not beg. Whatever round I can get, because I'm an actor. So this is how I look at this concept called delusion. Delusion is when an actor forgets that he or she is an actor and confuses himself or herself for the role. That is why we keep crying when the role gets over. We fear death. I mean, an actor doesn't fear the death of his character because it's fine. If it dies, I'll pick on another character if I want to. So this analogy I always feel is nice. And even when, you know, when it goes to the thing about when Swami says a worldly, there are different people who comes and ask question, but a jnani comes, Swami will never ask him what his doubts are. I think of that. I think of Swami as the director who is directing this whole drama on stage, and a jnani as an actor who knows that he's an actor. So imagine what will be a conversation between an actor like this and the director. The conversation will never be, oh my God, this poor fellow is so hungry. What? No. The actor who knows that he's an actor and just playing the role, he will just go into the intricacies of the plot and just admire the beautiful story, that's all. Be it a tragedy, be it a comedy, be it a horror movie, be it an action movie. We have seen it. You know, we have seen Shakespeare write tragedies. His tragedies are appreciated. We don't like tragedies in life, but we read tragedies. We don't like horror in life, but we watch horror movies. And that we are able to do because we know that it is false and we are doing it for entertainment. I feel that is the wisdom that comes with the jnani, who knows that all this is just for entertainment. You know, in this context, I just want to mention one interesting thing. I forget his name. There is one, some Anandaji, one Guruji is there, you know, and he keeps traveling different places in India and the world also, giving talks, and a very humble, sweet gentleman. In fact, if I remember right, he had given a few talks in our satsang hall also.
Mm-hmm.
So, why I'm telling this is, he had traveled along with us students when we went to visit the different places Swami visited in Badri and, you know, north. We did a pilgrimage to visit all the same places, and he also was there along with us in the bus. So it was wonderful to have his company, to enjoy his wisdom. He had a personal diary in which he would maintain his commitments, you know, next month where I'm talking, this month where I'm talking. So he had a calendar. You know, what was the name of the calendar? The calendar was named Time Pass 2014. So we were very intrigued. We said, what is this Time Pass 2014? He said, yeah, this is Time Pass only. You know, whether you go to office and work, or whether you go and talk about God, or whether you go to the farm, and all this is time pass only. We are here for something else. All this that we do is time pass. So that's why this is called Time Pass 2014. I feel, you know, that is a sign of a wise person, a person with wisdom, who knows that my role is just a time pass. I am an actor. I am not affected by birth, death, or anything like that. And therefore, when such a actor who knows that he's an actor discusses with the director, it will only be about the plot and what is the beauty of the story, and he'll be able to admire everything in the story, whether it's the a tragic thing or a comic thing or whatever. And that's why, you know, I every time think of this analogy of a drama in order to understand this concept of delusion. I don't say that this is a comprehensive example, but it definitely makes clear so many things about how both one can be both an actor as well as a role, and how perspective matters. From one perspective, nothing is in the hands of the actor because it's the director who is writing the script. But when you think of yourself as the role and keep doing in the movie, yeah, if I do this, this is what the consequence will be. If I do this, that is what the consequence will be. So therefore, both exist, destiny and self-effort or whatever, you know, free will, both exist, yet both mean the same thing.
And this is actually a very, very important question that he's asking, and you can make out that, you know, it's not a casual question of a confused person. We often do this. You know, we try to justify actions by saying that anyway, everything is God's will, and anyway, everything is destined. But he's not asking in that sense, because he's saying, I mean, the series of questions is very important. You know, the discussion is about peace of mind. And Swami is giving something to be done to achieve that peace of mind. And as we're going to see in the later part of the conversation, Swami, he's going to ask about why should anything be done at all? Right? We'll come to that later. But he's saying that you are telling me to do something to get peace of mind. So who is the doer? So does that mean that I as a human being can do something? If that is not the case, because that's what Swami is saying. Swami says that all is done by the Lord and not by you. So he's saying, if that is the case, then why should I be pulled up for a wrong crime or a crime that I'm being done, or be rewarded for something good that I'm being done? And Swami is talking about delusion, which is probably very, very subtle. In fact, in Upanishads, the truth is called satya, but delusion is not called asatya. You know, there's a different word for that.
Mithya.
Yeah, it's called mithya. The antonym for satya should be asatya, but they use the word mithya. And that famous Adi Shankara Shloka, he says, Brahma Satyam Jagan Mithya, he says, Jagat Mithya, which means, the word Mithya means, it is not real, but it appears to be real. It's not just that it's unreal, it is unreal and it appears to be real as long as you're in delusion. Like, it's just like, you know, the other beautiful example that Swami gives.
And I feel that word itself, you know, illusion, when a magician does an illusion, that's what it is. That's why I think they have given the word illusion and delusion. Because we know it that it is not true.
No, it is not knowing also. That is the thing. See, the thing is, if you know, you become a jnani. The thing is, even if you don't know, that's why Swami is saying that you're deluded. You think it is there, but actually it is not there. But it's so real that unless someone comes and points it out to you, you don't know that. And that's the later part where Swami is going to tell about why it is important to know from another person. I don't know whether it comes here or in another discourse, Swami explains that, because it is like the first time when you see a mirage and you've not heard of a mirage. When you're driving down a deserted road, the first time you've not seen it, you'll really be struck. I mean, I recall that as a child, that very vivid understanding of thinking that there's a puddle of water there. And Swami says that once you go past that point and you realize that it's a mirage, it's not a water, that mirage will keep appearing to you, but you're not going to be deluded. That's why Swami says it's one thing that when you have seen it once, you will not see it again. So he says the delusion does not disappear then. The delusion stays, but you know exactly that it's a delusion.
The illusion stays.
Right, okay. The illusion stays. Swami is saying that is the state of the jnani, but right now you're under the influence of, you know, thinking that it is real. So all the reactions which go with that deluded state will come with you, be it fear or be it the feeling that if I go near, I can drink some water or all of that. Those real reactions come with an unreal sight that you have had. And I mean, that is why it is, when it comes to spirituality, it's not about it's there or it's not there. The moment your entire narrative is built on something which is appearing to be real, but it is not real, then you're talking of a different state altogether. It's not about binaries at all. It goes into the state of, you know, what they talk in quantum as probabilities, that either it is there here or it is not here, or it spends some time here, it spends some time there. It becomes a very complex state than a simple binary state.
At this point in time, I think we should allow our listeners and ourselves also to sink in, soak up what Swami has said and what we are discussing. So we will take a quick little break, dear listeners, and on the other side of the break, continue with this discussion.
సాయి నామ స్మరణం సాయి రూప ధ్యానం సదా మాకు ఇహ పరాలను సగు సాధనం. సాయి నామ స్మరణం సాయి రూప ధ్యానం సదా మాకు ఇహ పరాలను సగు సాధనం. పప నిరమ గమ పమ గమ ద నిరి ని సా ధని సరి గమ గరి గరి సా ని ద ప గమ రి గరి. ఆలోచనగన్ని సాయి మయమే అయితే ఆలోచనగన్ని సాయి మయమే అయితే ఆవేదనలేమి మనకుండబులే. ఆలోచనరణి సాయిమయమే అయితే ఆవేదనలేమి మనకుండబులే. మనసు తను సర్వం గురుమూర్తే అయితే జీవకోటి అనంతమీ ప్రపంచవలయంలో మానవ జన్మం ఎంతో విలువైనదిగా. భగవంతుని గ్రహించే జ్ఞానమనే శక్తి భగవంతుని గ్రహించే జ్ఞానమనే శక్తి పొందగలుగు జన్మ ఇదే అని చాటిన సాయి. సాయి నామ స్మరణం సాయి రూప ధ్యానం సదా మాకు ఇహ పరాలను సగు సాధనం.
Welcome back, dear listeners. Swami is explaining about delusion, how delusion causes confusion. It reminds me of a very famous example again, which Swami used to give and we have read about, is the confusion that causes great anxiety and stress to Emperor Janaka. It is said that once Emperor Janaka, while sitting in the court, it's a hot afternoon, and unconsciously, without knowing it, he dozes off. And when he dozes off, he gets a dream. In the dream, what happens is his kingdom has been conquered by some enemy and he has been thrown to the roads. He doesn't have proper clothes. He is running. He gets into a jungle. There's no food. There's nothing. He's hungry, thirsty, tired, in tattered rags now almost. That time he comes across a place where somebody is giving food to everybody. So he goes there to get food, but there the condition is you must have your own mud pot in which they will give you rice. So he doesn't seem to have a mud pot. He goes to the other beggars and begs them for a mud pot. And when he doesn't get it, he sees a broken pot in a place, picks up one of the pieces of that. By the time now he reaches the place where the food is being given, it's almost over. The rice is over. There is some rice water, you know, because you cook rice with water. Some of that water is remaining at the bottom of that vessel, and that is what is served, and he's happy to get that. And story goes that when he walks away, there are two bulls that are fighting each other, and in their fight, one of the bull comes and, you know, hits him or nudges him, because of which this pot also, this broken pot piece with rice water also falls off, and he's in a state of, oh my God, he's in a state of extreme deprivation, when suddenly he wakes up. He wakes up and he finds himself sitting in a royal court. There's a choicest of food beside him. There are two people fanning him and entertainment is going on. And now he starts getting a doubt whether is this also a dream. I mean, what is the guarantee that suddenly again I will not wake up and I am in some other place? I mean, this whole palace thing, is this a dream or is it real? And story goes that when he wakes up, he's broken. He breaks into a sweat. Seeing that the queen comes running and asks, oh, Maharaj, what happened? He just turns to her and says, tell me, is that real or is this real? And she's not able to make out what it is. This doubt perplexes him so much that Janaka stops speaking anything else. He stops doing anything else. Whomever he meets, whoever greets him, the only thing Janaka keeps asking is this real or is that real? People are not able to make out what is this, nor are they able to make out what is that. And that is the doubt that Sage Yajnavalka actually clears for him.
It's Vasishta.
Sage Vasishta.
Okay. They call Vasishta for this, and at least that's what Swami says.
Okay.
That Sage Vasishta is called to, I mean, because nobody knows what is going wrong, because Janaka is doing nothing but repeating Adinijamai. Is that true or is this true?
Okay.
So they bring Vasishta and he
clarifies.
I get
confused.
Right?
There's another thing where he's told to give the mind. Anyway, so doesn't matter which is the sage, but that wise being comes and tells Janaka that neither of them is true. You know? And that is a shocker for Janaka. And all the others in the court, nobody is able to understand what's going on. First of all, they're not able to understand what the king is meaning by saying, is this true or that true? And here is the wise being coming and giving the answer and saying, neither of them is true. The one who is witnessing both, that is you, you alone are true. And then Janaka has his moment of enlightenment. You know, once again, if you allow me, I would like to take this back to the drama analogy. Just imagine there is an actor who is playing the role of the king, and the same thing happens. He's sitting in the court and he dozes off and has a dream, and he is now wondering whether what happened in the dream, whether that is true or this is true. And the wise actor, the one who has realized the truth that this is just a role and we are all actors in reality, will come and tell him that neither is true. You are neither a beggar nor are you a king. If you think you are a king, that's also a delusion, because that is just the role that you are doing. Neither is true. You alone are true. So that is the delusion. That is the thing about being confused. And though with these analogies, intellectually we are able to understand and appreciate, we are still very, very far away from practicing it and living it every moment of our life. So when Swami says, getting over delusion or getting over confusion, I am sure it refers to living it and experiencing that truth every moment of our life, being able to recognize mithya and being able to associate with satya every moment of our experiential life. That is what is the state of being delusion free. Otherwise, we are still in delusion, except for these momentary sparks or bursts of clarity.
And then from there, as we said, you know, Swami talks about a jnani coming and asking, and the way Swami would interact with him will be completely different versus somebody coming and asking doubts. So Swami says the fact that you have questions is evidence that you are on the worldly level. And Baba's teachings will vary according to the level of the person. And then Swami continues to say, a teacher in a school may at the same time be a renowned Vedic scholar. But when teaching a child to read, he can only say, this letter is A, this letter is I, and so on. Mother may feed one child at the breast, give soft food to another, tell the cook to serve food to another, and tell the eldest to serve himself.
Mm.
But though her treatment of each child may be different, her love is equal for all. There are four different stages in which man finds himself, and God gives different but appropriate help to each. First are those people who are in distress. Second are those desiring prosperity. Third are those engaged in inquiry and as to what is the truth. And the fourth are the wise ones.
It reminds one of the shloka from the Bhagavad Gita wherein Krishna says, Chaturvidha bhajante mam janaha sukrutino arjuna arto jignyasu artharti jnani cha bharatarshabaha. Artha, Artharti, Jignyasu and Jnani. And I think there is one beautiful Chinnakatha that Swami narrates to explain this. Swami says that there was this man who had four wives.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was going on a foreign tour, he asked them what they want. One wife tells that, you know, I want these jewelry. I want in that country you will get this kind of handbag. You will get these clothes, this jewelry. These are the things that I want. The other wife says that I am suffering so much from this disease. None of the medication locally available is helping. See if you can get some good medicines from abroad which can help me get better. And Swami says that the third wife says that she would like to read a lot of books and ask for some good books which will inculcate noble thoughts and nobility in her. And finally, Swami says, the fourth wife, when the husband asks, what do you want? She says, I want nothing. Have a safe trip and come back as soon as possible. I'll be waiting for you. I want you to come back. And then Swami says that the first wife is the artharti, one who is desirous of wealth. That is one kind of devotee who approaches God. Interestingly, in the Indian tradition, the wife calls her husband as Swami, meaning Lord or Master, that way, you know. So, Swami is also saying that is what it is. Swami is also approached by like these kind of devotees. In fact, it is said that God alone is the Purusha, everyone else is Prakriti, is Stri. So, in that sense, whether I am male or female, I am like a wife to the Lord. In the divine union, the Lord is the Purusha and we are Prakriti. So, the four kinds of devotees that approach. One is Artharti, who is desirous of wealth, seeking glory, you know, influence, career success, all this. That is one kind of devotee. The other kind of devotee is seeking redemption from suffering, you know, health suffering or any kind of suffering. So here is that is represented by the wife who asks for medicine. The third are jignyasu, one who are desirous of knowledge. That is represented by the wife who asks for books to enrich and enhance her knowledge. And finally, Swami says, is the jnani. The jnani is the one who is dearest to me, Swami says. That is what Krishna also says. The jnani is the one dearest to me because for the jnani, nothing else is needed. He is represented by the fourth wife who says, I don't want anything. Please come back to me as soon as you can. I'll be waiting for you. The jnani desires for the Lord and Lord alone. So these are the four kinds of devotees that Krishna describes to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita. That is the same that Swami is describing to Hislop in the interview room.
Right, and the other way of looking at these four categorizations, especially when you look at them as devotees, you know, when Swami says these four kinds of people come to me, the arthi is one who comes only when there's a need, only when there's distress, only when there's suffering. That's why it's always spoken of as the sick who come to Swami as Aarti. It's not necessarily that only sickness.
Not just physical sickness.
Right, it is just that momentary relief that you want and you turn to God. And you see that so often, you know, people who come, there are many, many people whom you meet and they say that, oh, we came to Patti 20 years ago and, you know, I came for a child, or Swami, my mother was not well and I came. And they've not come back after that because they've not had another problem which drew them to Swami. So the Aarti is actually the one who comes to Swami just for that immediate relief of a problem.
Almost like using Swami as an ATM.
Right, exactly. You just say that this problem needs to be solved when you come. The Arthaarti is one who, you know, Artha has no limit actually. You know, if you have 1 million today, you might want 2 million tomorrow. Or if you have one car today, you would be happier to have a bigger car tomorrow.
If you don't mind me butting in here, you know, I came to know that Swami was once told when the hospital was built that why don't we provide free treatment only to the poor, let the rich pay, they can afford for the treatment. Swami said nothing doing, it will be free for all. And later on, the logic that was explained was, how do you separate somebody as poor? You know, you may, in your eyes, relatively from your perspective, possibly a person who has $1,000 is poor, a person who has $3,000 is poor. But for all that you know, a person who is actually having that $3,000 may himself consider him to be poor. While a person who is just having $1,000 may still feel that, you know, I am not that poor, I am well-to-do. Because poverty indeed has got a lot to do with the levels of contentment that we have. That is why, as you say, Artharthi, one who is desirous of wealth, it's a never-ending journey, because nobody can actually say I am rich because of the amount that I own. That feeling of being rich, as Swami says, comes from who is the richest man in the world? He who has the most contentment is the richest man in the world. Who is the poorest man in the world? He that has most desires is the poorest man in the world.
Right. And the other way of actually describing Artha is one of the very beautiful and more profound and more relatable explanation they give for Artha. It's not just money, but it is security. Anything that makes you feel secure is Artha, actually. So even the relatives that are around you, the friends that are around you, the name that you have in the society, the reputation, or all of that things which make you feel secure, right? All of that comes under Artha. And when you come to God for more protection, when you come to God for reinforcing what you already have, you become an Artharthi. So there is a chance that an Artharthi will be with God for a longer time than an Arthi, because an Arthi will get what he wants and he'll go away. An Artharthi is because the desires are endless, and if he has the patience, if he transitions to that state where he's really a devotee, then he will come back to God every time there is a need. The third is actually the Jignasu who has come to the little understanding that all of this is pointless. That there is no point in gathering all of this. Anyway, sometime it's going to go. A little bit of maturity and understanding. So he's probably, Hislop might be categorized as a Jignasu. Because he's coming and asking questions. He says, if I don't get answers for these questions, I cannot have peace of mind. And he is asking questions which has not been answered in so many places. He has come seeking answers from Swami. And in his own words, he says that the answers which he got from Swami are more profound than anybody else's. But finally, Swami says, it's a jnani who says, you know, even when you give that example of the Chinnakatha, Swami would say that actually speaking the wisest with the fourth wife, because she knew that here is the center of everything else. You know, instead of asking husband for getting this and that, she was asking for the husband itself, like the other Chinnakatha, which would say the lady who chose the emperor than the objects that the emperor was trying to, you know, give to the citizens. So the jnani is one who has that ultimate maturity that I don't need anything else. I just need God. And if I have God, I have everything else. So that is the gradation which Swami says. And Swami says that depending on what you come for, I will also respond. And Swami gives another analogy where he says that depending on your ability to digest what you get, that's how God is going to give you what, you know, you ask for. And just because you come and ask for Brahmajnan, if you're not prepared for that, there's no point in God giving it to you. And even if it is given, it's just going to be discarded.
Swami continues explaining to Dr. John Hislop. He says, this is a big answer that Swami has given. So after speaking about the four different stages or the four kinds of people who come to him, Swami says, at present in you, there is a mixture of conscious and subconscious. For this reason, there is confusion and doubt. In the unconscious state, there are no impressions. In the superconscious state, there is no doubt. There is decision. In this state, there is no body and no mind, although there may be visions. There is still another state beyond the superconscious. This is divine consciousness, where God alone is. In a superconscious state, there is still a very slight tinge of duality, of giver and receiver. In the ordinary state, there are three, giver, gift and receiver. In divine consciousness, there is giver alone. Really, all other than the one is false. Even sadhana. Here a doubt may arise. How can sadhana, something false, result in something other than false? It is like this. Dreaming is unreal. But the dream may become so strong, so terrifying, that because of the dream one awakens. It is likewise with sadhana. For sadhana to become so strong that from it one awakens to reality, the sadhana must touch the superconscious level where both body and mind are transcended. It is from the deep transcendent state that truth blazes forth.
This is, I think, a little heavy explanation which Swami is giving. But I really hope we could have had the untranslated version of this. I'm sure this is the translation that whoever was translating Swami's words was writing down. Mm. Because when Swami says superconscious, unconscious, whether Swami said these English words or did Swami use the equivalent Sanskrit words?
Not equivalent, I mean the Sanskrit word for which they thought that this is equivalent.
These are things. Because one of the things you can, it appears like is Swami is talking of the four states which you often talk of, you know, where the fourth or the supreme being, Turiya. Mm. The meaning of Turiya itself means the fourth state, because there's no description of that. And Swami would say, Sushupti is that deep sleep state. I think we spoke a little about that even last week, right, about the deep sleep state, how that is a state where you touch your the true self.
Mm.
And Swami would say that, you know, when you get up from a very deep sleep state, you were not conscious enough to know what was happening in the deep sleep state. But when you come out of deep sleep, you know that you had a good sleep.
Hmm.
You'll always say that I had very good sleep.
And you know it.
You know it. So Swami says that the very fact that you know it means that the ego is not completely gone. It is still there.
Hmm.
The feeling of I am is still there. That is why you're able to enjoy that state. And that's why Swami is saying that, you know, even in that super conscious state, if we were to, we hope we're doing this right, if that superconscious state is the Sushupti which Swami speaks about, Swami is saying that in the superconscious state, there is no doubt, there is decision. There's usually clarity. That's what Swami says when you wake up from a good night's sleep. There's so much of clarity which comes, not because of any thinking that you've done, right? Mm-hmm. When you wake up after a good night's sleep, it's not like you've deliberated over a problem in the night.
Mm-hmm.
It is just that deep sleep which has come out and you suddenly can see things more clearly. I mean, you see this so often, even for something as small as when you're, you know, preparing for a talk or writing an article. You know, there'll be some concept which is really stuck up and knotted up. Mm. You wake up early in the morning, you'll find that everything is sorted out. Now you know what it is. So it is not out of deliberation. That's what Swami is saying, that there is no doubt, there is no thinking, but there is just decision in this state. There is no body, no mind, although there may be visions. There is still another state beyond the superconscious, and that is the divine consciousness. If you could call the divine consciousness as the state of Turiya. Then Swami talks of the conscious and the three other states. The unconscious is, of course, you're completely knocked out. I guess there's nothing to be felt in that. But Swami is talking about the conscious state and the subconscious state. And invariably, the subconscious state is what is related to the dream state, where whatever is your subconscious impressions, they actually come out. Mm. And many times the dream is a combination, they say, of what you experience through the day plus what is coming up from your deep consciousness, I mean, from your past life, and all of that thing together forms your dream. And of course, Swami is saying about the conscious state where, you know, you see, you decide, there is confusion, there is doubt, and all of that.
And then Swami goes on to say that really, other than this one, all other things are false. And therefore, even sadhana becomes false, you know. Because if this existence, like how Janaka was told that, your dream state is false, but even this is false. Then the question naturally arises, why am I doing sadhana? Because if my existence as Arvind is itself mithya, it is not reality, if it's an illusion, what is the use of, doing sadhana here? And Swami beautifully, this is so nice that Swami himself preempts the question. He himself brings up the question and gives the answer. It is almost like Swami saying that, boss, this question, this doubt is going to come sometime in your head. Whether you recognize it now or not, I'll give off the answer right away. So Swami is saying that sadhana is that effort which actually wakens you up from your dream, which awakens you from the dream, wakes you up from your dream. It startles you, like in that case of Janaka, that when he is there hungry, thirsty, and he has tried his best and somehow managed to get some little food, even that is knocked over by some bulls fighting nearby, that actually wakes him up from his dream. The Swami says sadhana is like that. When it's done intensely and perseveringly, it will result in waking you up. That awakening, for that sadhana is important. That's why Swami would say that once you are awakened, you don't need to do sadhana. I mean, I don't think Swami ever did Namasmarana, though he kept telling us. On the face of it would look like hypocrisy. Swami, you are telling us to do Namasmarana, you yourself don't do Namasmarana. Swami doesn't need Namasmarana. Because sadhana is something that we need to wake us up from that dream state. And that is what Swami himself raised the question and answers it. Then Hislop goes on to say that, Swami, one hears about various paths to self-realization. What does this mean? And Swami says, there are three paths. There is that of devotion. The guru guides and all is left to the guru to perform. Then there is perception that God is omnipresent. The future comes up to the present and the past falls away from the present. God is omnipresent. So the present is God. This is knowledge. Then there is surrender to God. But surrender does not mean doing all actions in His name. Surrender to God is when the entire universe is known as His body. Surrender is when doer, deed and object are all one. It cannot be forced. It comes naturally. Faith is the foundation. Surrender is the peak.
So again, there's a pretty complex explanation that Swami is giving. In the moment when Swami says there are three paths, the simplest thing you think of is that, karma, bhakti, jnana, or, meditation and inquiry or whatever it is. But what Swami is telling is completely different in that sense. Swami is saying first there is devotion to Guru, or rather I think you could rephrase that as obedience to Guru, where the Guru says and you just do, you don't question anything at all, and everything is left to the wisdom of the Guru. But the second is a little more complex, where Swami is saying that you see God everywhere and the God is omnipresent, and you see the past actually falling away and the future merging in God. I think that's a state of completely not being worried about anything in the future, or the state where, Hislop is asking, that why should I be criticized for an action that I'm doing? Why should I be rewarded for something good I'm doing? All of that comes because you see that continuity. I did something in the past, I'm something in the present, and something happens in the future. Swami is talking about a state where you cut off everything. You're just living in the present and you consider the present as God, if that's what Swami is meaning. And then, of course, the third one is Swami talks about surrender. I think it is nothing but the state of devotion, where, you're completely given up to the wills of God. Not because, there's probably a difference between what Swami says is the first state, where you obey the Guru. You obey the Guru also for a certain purpose. Right? The very reason that you go to a person and become his disciple and say that you instruct me and I'll do whatever you say, you believe that he is going to take me somewhere and I'll just follow whatever he says. Mm. But when you talk about surrender, you're not even talking about reaching somewhere. You're not even talking about gaining something. It's a state of pure love where you say that, you are there, that is enough for me. And that probably is the third state where Swami says. That's why Swami is saying it starts with faith, but it actually culminates in surrender.
I was reminded of a statement I think we read in the Bhagavata Vahini. Or was it somewhere else? I clearly remember the statement because I was thrilled by the beauty of it, wherein Swami says that karma is bhakti towards the Virata Purusha.
Mm-hmm.
Karma is nothing but devotion to the cosmic being.
Right.
Okay, so karma yoga means devotion to the cosmic being. Cosmic being is what Swami would say, the sahasra shirsha purushah sahasraksha sahasrapat. The cosmic being has thousands of heads, thousands of hands and thousands of eyes. Meaning every head that you see, every hand that you see, in other words, everything that you see in creation is the cosmic divine. And when you have devotion towards that cosmic divine, that is what is called karma, you know, good karma. That is the karma marga. And I think in that flow of wisdom, Swami was showing that whether you call it karma, bhakti or jnana, all of them have love for God. If that love for God is not there, it is not a path to God. Because you cannot have a path to divinity without love for God. So, from that perspective when I see this frame, because again, it's all about perspective, I felt that this still adheres to the three paths. When Swami says, the first path is that of devotion. Devotion, that is the bhakti marga. The second is that of knowledge. Swami himself is saying that. You know, the present, it's of knowledge. When you're in that state of knowledge, you're beyond time, you're beyond space, the path of knowledge. And third, Swami says, is when the entire universe is known as his body. Therefore, that is how Swami defined perfect seva, right? When you do seva, it is not that I am helping somebody else. I am helping myself. And Swami would give the analogy of how the hand goes and pulls out a thorn from the leg. Not because I want to serve the leg, but simply because leg is part of me. It's me only. I am able to see everything as me because I am the cosmic being and everybody is also the cosmic being. So in that sense, I felt that this is also the three paths of bhakti, jnana, karma only.
Right.
And the way, what I just felt is the way Swami guides, the way Guru guides in each of these three paths is slightly different basing on your approach. For that I remembered actually, there is something called this Kishora Nyayas. Mm-hmm. Marjala Kishora Nyaya, Markata Kishora Nyaya. And though these two are common, I somewhere read about a Kurma Kishora Nyaya also. And it is said that in Markata Kishora Nyaya, it is like the baby monkey which holds on to the mother monkey wherever the mother monkey may jump. And that is how I feel is possibly the karma marga, you know, the karma marga where that is the role the guru or God plays, like that of the mother monkey, where I know that the devotee will put in efforts to hold on to me. Let him hold on, let him or her hold on. I will take him where he has to be taken. The second is Marjala Kishora Nyaya, which is that like that of a cat and a kitten. Here, there is complete, you know, this I feel is like the bhakti marga, where total devotion, you surrender to God, and God is like the mother cat, who will himself come and carry you, you know, with the same teeth with which you can kill a rat, the same teeth hold you tenderly and take you wherever you need to be taken. And these are the two common ones that I came across, but I remember clearly reading about a Kurma Kishora Nyaya, the way a mother turtle cares for the baby turtles. And this I have also seen with my own eyes when I had been to Trinidad and Tobago. The mother comes and lays the eggs and goes away. And when the hatchlings come, the mother is present only at the water's edge, you know,
mm-hmm.
from a distance. And it's automatically the little ones that have hatched, they make a mad rush towards the sea because something is programmed within. And in this Kurma Kishora Nyaya, it is said that simply with her sight, the mother is guiding the turtles, baby turtles, where they should go. I don't know if actually it is like that with the sight, but that's how it is said. And I feel this is what the Lord will do towards a jnani. That is why Swami says, for some, I will take and breastfeed them. The mother breastfeeds. For some, the mother serves and tells, eat on your own. And for the third, the mother even doesn't bother. Mother says, ah, it's kept on the table, go and eat. So that is how I just felt that it matches these three paths. And the thing is, when you are on the path of karma, when you are on the path of bhakti, and when you are on the path of jnana, the same Lord responds in a different manner because your needs are different. So it is the same Lord. It is the same goal. It's just that basing on what your strengths are and what your, aptitude and attitude is, the Lord also differs in his response.
I think that's a that's a more accurate way of looking at it, because that's, I think that at least the last point makes a lot of sense when Swami says that you look at the entire universe as the Lord's body.
Mm.
Because Swami would say that when you start serving, it is not like, you know, you're serving in the name of God, you're actually serving God in others. And, you know, that is one way of looking at karma itself. But then, you know, when Swami speaks about all of these paths, probably a question which would come in most of our minds is what Hislop is voicing. He says, of the many roads to self-realization, what is the shortcut? And he's saying, you know, why labor in on the other roads when you know what is the best path or when is the shortest? And who better can tell that or reveal that than Swami? So he's asking, of the many roads to self-realization, what is the shortcut? And Swami says, again, very straight and categorically, the shortcut is this way. The name of God is the seed. Love is the water by which the crop grows. Discipline is the fence which protects the growing crop. The field in which the crop is grown is the spiritual heart. The crop, when it comes to harvest, is bliss. So that is Swami's answer. And Swami says it all starts with the name of the Lord, chanting of the name.
And actually, if we see that, it is like Swami has blended all the three paths of karma, bhakti, jnana into a path which is quite unique and I think tailor-made for the Kali Yuga. Because, you know, I was reading it came as a email forward or a WhatsApp forward, I don't remember, but it was very interesting and intriguing that how in the Satya Yuga, there were two separate species, the Danavas and the Manavas, you know, the good people and the bad, they were separate species. And God took birth, whether it is those initial avatars, Matsya, Kurma, Varaha, all, to come and decimate one species and protect the other species. But as time went on and Satya Yuga changed to Treta Yuga, in the same species now you had good and bad. So therefore, the Lord came in a human form, and within the same species, He destroys one and He protects the other. It said that when the next Yuga came, forget within the same species, within the same family, you had evil and good. So it became little more tough, it needed little more finesse. That is why the Krishna Avatara comes and, you know, destroys all the evil within one family and nourishes the good in the same family. When that changes to Kali Yuga, in Kali Yuga, in the same individual you have got. So the surgery becomes much more complicated and it requires much more finesse. Where the bad in an individual has to be transformed and the good has to be nourished. And that is why I think Kali Yuga is a totally different ball game, totally different ball game. And that is why Swami prescribes a sadhana like this. And, you know, when Swami, when the avatar is prescribing this, I think we should just take and follow it. Start with Namasmarana, with bhakti. You know, that is the thing. It's not just about chanting the name of the Lord. It has to be watered by love, that Swami says. At the same time, it doesn't mean that I can lead a wayward life. Discipline, karma, you know, that is where karma also comes in. There is discipline also needed. Swami says the fence is discipline. In order to get the fruit of bliss and fruit of knowledge, the Advaita Jnana, Swami says you need to plant the seed of the name of the Lord, water it with love, and then protect it with the fence of discipline. And then all this should happen in the spiritual heart. So I think Swami beautifully, for the sake of the Kali Yuga, has blended all these. And as it becomes very clear here, it all begins with Namasmarana.
And I think all three of that is equally important, as Swami would have said it many, many times. You know, Swami says, love is the water which the crop grows. One is looking at it as devotion. The other is as a nature itself. Right? Mm. I mean, if some of the discourses where Swami would give to the residents in the ashram. I think we went through some of those discourses in the course of, you know, when unpleasantness is encountered in the ashram. And we've seen how Swami has said in that. Because you find samples of so many of people who follow one of this or two of this. You know, there are people who are very, very dedicated to some kind of worship, you know, be it bhajans or coming and doing meditation or something. But you find that the love and the karma aspect is missing.
Mm.
You know, you find that they're probably not doing anything or they're not loving enough. Or you find some people who are very, very rigorous when it comes to karma. But then you find that they're lacking in the love towards the people they interact. And sometimes Swami would say that you're very, very sincere. You do whatever you're supposed to do. You'd find some people like that also. And who are also very kind. You know, by nature, they're very good people. But you're actually not doing the spiritual sadhana which is supposed to back the whole thing.
Mm.
You know, you're doing your work properly. You're not hurting anybody in that sense. But the sense that you're doing work as sadhana is missing because you're not doing the namasmarana. Swami would come and say, what is the point? You know, you're actually doing what I can get done from probably a regular worker. Mm. You're not seeing this as I'm giving you an opportunity. So these three things are very, very important. Namasmarana, but along with that, the nature which is seeing God in everybody and being loving to everybody, and that discipline. And Swami would say that you can never give up that discipline aspect at all.
I think to end this heavy session, each of us can narrate one incident. I'll narrate an incident where Swami has said Namasmarana is a very good and most important sadhana for this. And I think you narrate an incident where without Namasmarana, even if we are actually doing noble task, we are missing out on an opportunity. The first happened to one of the professors in our university, Professor Nanjundaya. And he was narrating how once when they had been to Hyderabad, Shivam, he saw how the great Vedic scholar Kamavadani Garu would stand outside Swami's bathroom and chant the Vedas. And when asked why that was being done, he got the reply that the Abhishekam is happening inside, which is such a beautiful thought, you know. When Swami is taking bath, it is Abhishekam to the deity in the Sanctum Sanctorum. So when Abhishekam happens, Veda Goshana has to happen. So that's why I'm chanting the Vedas. And seeing this, Nanjundaya sir felt how blessed indeed was Kamavadani that he's getting this opportunity of chanting the Vedas when Abhishekam is happening to the life form of the Lord. And he felt a little sad also because he felt that since he did not know the Vedas, he is missing out on this glorious opportunity. And then the bathroom door opened and Swami comes out and Swami is looking so fresh and radiant. It's amazing. You know, Swami is always fresh and radiant, but this is like fresh. Come and so much of tejas, so much of glow, and just seeing him, you feel like shedding tears of joy. And naturally everybody there bows down in joy, folds their hand. But Swami straight goes to Kamavadani and asks him, Kamavadani, in order to get moksha in life, in order to get the ultimate in life, is it necessary to know the Vedas and, you know, the way you are chanting it? And immediately Kamavadani answers, this great Vedic scholar says, no Swami, namasmaraname dhanyopayam. Meaning, Swami, why all these Vedas not needed? If you just chant the name of the Lord, that is more than enough. Instantly Swami looks at Professor Nanjundaya and almost as if to say, did you get that point? And Professor Nanjundaya was saying that it's so amazing because Swami himself prescribed that namasmarana is enough. If you don't know anything also, it doesn't matter. So I'm not surprised that while talking to Hislop also, Swami begins by saying namasmarana is the seed, that namasmarana is so very important.
And probably to end with that, you know, the thought that Swami is saying that it's not just namasmarana, but it should lead to love. In that sense, if you think of it, I feel that one of the most graphic examples you can think of is somebody like the dacoit Ratnakara. You know, he's a dacoit. He represents everything that we all, the most evil part of us, which is selfishness, right? We're ready to do anything to benefit ourselves. That's what he represented, probably the most, you know, the wrong expression of that quality. That he was ready to even kill people so that he benefits himself and his family. So we all know the story that he's made to sit down and he's made to chant the name of the Lord. At the end of it, he comes out as Sage Valmiki. And the first episode which we narrate about his life is, he goes for his morning ablutions to the river and he finds one bird being shot down and he breaks down. That's how tender his heart has become. You know, a hard-hearted dacoit becomes so tender that he's not able to see the death of a bird. That is what Namasmarana is meant to do to your heart. If that is not happening, then Namasmarana is becoming very mechanical. So there should be Namasmarana, but that should also lead to that tenderness, that love, which comes from that constant repetition of the name.
In fact, just as an aside to that same story, it is said that that anguish causes him to burst forth in a shloka.
Right.
It is said, Shokatvam shlokam agataha. means from his shoka, sorrow, came the shloka. And he says, Ma nishada pratishtam tvamagama shashwati samaha yatkrauncha mithuna dekamavadi kama mohitam. And that shloka is supposed to be in a meter in which the entire Ramayana later gets composed. And this Ratnakara, who was illiterate, who was uncouth, uncivilized, knew nothing, him coming out with a shloka in such a meter, in such perfection, with so much of tenderness of heart. Yes, as you rightly said, that is what Namasmarana does to the heart. And that is how later he goes on to write the entire Ramayana itself. In fact, it is said that Brahma, Lord Brahma, the creator, comes and tells him that this ability that you have acquired, now you are ready to write the Ramakatha and go ahead and write the Ramakatha. It is also an inspiration for people like you and me who, if I can say in quotes, are professionally in this field of reading and spreading the Sai Katha. This is what Brahma said that qualifies Valmiki for now writing the Ramakatha. I think we should also make this Namasmarana a very integral part of our day-to-day life, because if, as I said, especially you and me, if we feel that we are to narrate the Sai Katha, our hearts also should be soaked in his name and should have that much compassion and feeling. And we pray to Swami that he grants us that. He's always been showering us more than what we deserve. We are grateful to that, Swami. And we hope that our love for you keeps growing every passing moment. On that note, dear listeners, we will end this afternoon satsang. And I think, after...
We want to end with a special instrumental, because this is our latest release. It was released just yesterday. It's part of the Melodic series, Melodic Stories series. So if you want the story behind this particular track, as you know that it always comes with a beautiful incident, then you'll have to visit our website for it. But I'm going to play only the bhajan instrumental. I'm sure that you will enjoy it. I mean, I was really thrilled to listen to it. It's a very, very beautiful rendition of a Sai bhajan in Nadaswaram, which is quite rare these days. So we'll listen to this. We're going to leave you with this track. On the other side of it, you'll of course be joined by Brother Chandu for his episode Love to Love. The artist who performed this beautiful melody is a very accomplished artist. His name is Adayarv Balasubramaniam, and you can catch the entire track on our website, radiosai.org.